You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
Hey there, and welcome to the Feed Feed podcast. I'm Alexa Santos, a senior producer at the Feed Feed. The Feed Feed is the world's largest crowdsourced food publication and social media community, serving as your daily source for what to cook, bake, eat, and drink. Here on the podcast, we are speaking with members of the hashtag Feed Feed community to hear their stories, learn about their culinary inspirations, and get some of their best cooking tips. Today, I'm so excited to be joined by Chef Jeremy Salomon. Jeremy is a chef primarily focusing on Jewish and Eastern European cuisine. He is also a restaurant owner and entrepreneur, having just opened Aggie's Counter in Crown Heights, Brooklyn last fall. Aggie's Counter is named after Jeremy's Hungarian grandmother, Aggie, and the spot opened as a lunch counter and all-day cafe bakery. They're now serving all meals, and with heavy Jewish and Eastern European influences, Aggie's is Jeremy's first solo venture. He was previously the executive chef of The Eddie and Wallflower. Wow, what a resume you've got there, my friend.
That's a mouthful, yeah.
So let's run this back to the very, very beginning. I want to learn about kind of how you started falling in love with food and turning this into a career. So tell me where you grew up and who was kind of your first inspiration with food.
Sure. So I grew up in Boca Raton, Florida.
Oh my gosh. Wait, I grew up in Fort Lauderdale. Well, West End.
Oh my God. We probably know people.
Yes, I'm sure we do.
It is a very small town, even though it seems pretty big. But yeah, I grew up in Boca Raton, Florida, with a lot of elderly people.
Yes.
Golf carts and Jewish delis. And my inspiration, I would say, is were my two grandmothers, and also my mother. So, predominantly the women in my life, since they provided for the family food wise and in many other ways. And that was very inspiring to me. So, yeah.
Amazing. So what are your ethnicities on both sides of your family?
Yeah. So, on my father's side, I am Hungarian, so second generation Hungarian. My grandmother spent some time in Austria, but she was born and raised in Budapest. And her husband, my grandfather, was born in Czechoslovakia, which, that's a complicated history there. But Hungary, pretty much all around. And then interestingly enough, we just found out. So my mother she was adopted, and her parents are Sephardic Jews. Mm-hmm. But she just took one of those tests and found out that she is also Hungarian.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hungarian, a little Russian and Polish, but predominantly Hungarian. So by blood, I'm Hungarian all around.
Yeah. You're Eastern European, like through and through, pretty much.
Yeah. Dill is in my blood. Yeah.
Yes. So what type of food did you grow up eating? Obviously, I'm familiar with growing up in South Florida, and there's, a lot of different influences down here. And, I don't know which side of your family or who was doing most of the cooking at home, but what was some of the food that you grew up eating and enjoying?
Yeah, I grew up on a very American 90s diet. In Boca Raton, Florida. I wish it was some sort of, whimsical story that I ate all these, exotic Eastern European foods. And I guess I did to an extent. But really, my grandmother, Aggie, only cooked for us. She would cook one day a week at a big family dinner, like on a Saturday or Sunday night. And she had goulash, which is like braised meat. And she had mm-hmm. no kedli, which is like little teardrop dumplings. And you know, all these other sort of Hungarian dishes, but it was intertwined with eggplant Parmesan and steak Diane and just kind of all these American staples. But otherwise than that, I mean, I had a Cheesecake Factory right down the street from me.
Yes.
My mother packed me a PB&J sandwich. She made meatballs at night. And I don't know. So I think like a pretty standard, you know, childhood American diet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always talk. It's interesting on the podcast. Sometimes I'll have someone who, I don't know, grew up in China or something and then moved over here. And it's so funny to, you know, hear about how much better they were eating than we were growing up, like especially in the 90s where everything was like slime and like green ketchup and like those kid cuisines with just like and Lunchables and all these like disgusting like processed. Like we were not doing it right back then. And I feel like,
I mean, honestly, what a time to be alive.
It was a time. It was a moment in history.
Yeah.
It was something that I just remember I would go to the Blockbuster with my dad to pick out movies for the weekend. And I'm so grateful that now he would never, you know, you'd be standing in line at Blockbuster and there'd be these like gross, you know, containers of like candy that were like slime, sour goo or whatever. And I'd always be like, daddy, I want those so bad. And he'd be like, no, that's disgusting. Like you don't want that. And he would never buy me the like slime goo candy. And now I'm like, you know what? I think that was for the best. I think we came out on top, but I did. I definitely, you know, was eating the frozen prepackaged, you know, all the colors and dyes and artificial everything. And then I'm very glad that as a society, we realized like, huh, what if we tried eating real food? What a novel idea. So I totally get it. So who was it or when was it that you started being so passionate about cooking yourself?
Yeah, it probably wasn't until I was like 10 or 11. And my mom's mom, Arlene, she belonged to this club and she had asked the chef if he would entertain me with a job of some sort. And so she harassed him and finally I got this like apprenticeship, as if you would call it,
where I was staging?
Kind of. I mean, I didn't know that it was called a stage.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I'm just throwing around lingo so I sound like it.
Well, that's pretty good. No, I mean, definitely a cool word. But yeah, I guess I took on a job like 1 or 2 days a week after school, and they started out by putting me in the freezer with a big jacket, and I would have my CD player and I'd listen to music while I scooped ice cream and sorbets into martini glasses for big banquets. So that was my start, and I think it really began because I don't know. I always go back. I mean, I could attribute it to my mother, who always likes to remind me that I was very impatient. I was a very impatient diner in restaurants, so I never wanted to sit still. You know, I was definitely the child that screamed or cried, like that nobody wanted to deal with.
Oh boy!
So she created this sort of a distraction where she would say, okay, Jeremy, you're going to cook the food. And using the utensils and like the sugar packets at the table, we would make each dish that we ordered. And she would kind of like hopefully time it up where the food came out behind, you know, out of the kitchen. She'd be like, oh, great, you cooked the food. And I don't like, I remember doing that. But she likes to say that, oh, I'm the reason why. So, I don't know if that was the reason, but definitely I ate very well as a child. And I think just the women in my life were very proactive in getting me engaged in the kitchen. So,
well, that's lovely. And so when did you decided at a certain point to go to culinary school? What was kind of the journey there?
Yeah, it was always drilled in me to go to culinary school. All the chefs, all the jobs that I had throughout high school and middle school, everyone was telling me I had to go. So I went and went to the Culinary Institute of America, which is in Hyde Park, New York.
Oh, yes.
And the Hogwarts of cooking schools.
Yes.
And it was Yeah, it was great. It was also just not for me. So a year in, I dropped out. I had come from a working background, and even with cooking in throughout my childhood and in professional kitchens, and my grandfather and my father were in business together. They owned a surgical supply business and a pharmacy. So I would sometimes work the counter. I've just been working, and school just didn't give me that. So I figured, why put myself through this? I can just paid to be learned.
Paid to learn. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I don't want to, you know, talk bad about culinary school, but I've heard that a lot from, I did not personally go to culinary school. I would have loved to, but it was, you know, not, I went to traditional college. So at the time, you know, I was, yeah. You know, you graduate and you work. It's not like, okay, let me spend more money to, and also not make any income for more time. But people, as I've gotten into food media and met a lot of different people throughout different, you know, aspects of the culinary space, whether that's working at a restaurant or creating content or, you know, working for food media, it becomes more and more apparent that just get it, you know, like cutting your teeth, whether that be in the restaurant or in your own kitchen recipe developing, just actually doing it and learning that way is what a lot of people really say makes a lot more sense. And so I've heard a lot of that. And so it'll be interesting to see in like the post COVID life that we're living, how, if, you know, that as many people as before are going to keep going to physical culinary school. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, culinary school, it definitely has it serves its purpose to, you know, those who may not have had experience in kitchens before. It also doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go to culinary school and then open up a restaurant. You know, there are plenty of people who go work in hotels or go work on boats or become sommeliers or managers of hotels. And culinary school actually is probably a really great base for an occupation like that.
Right.
But I've heard people, you know, from all different backgrounds and experience levels say various things, that it really helped them and it also didn't help them. So I think it just really depends on what your needs are, you know, and who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. So you leave culinary school and start working in restaurants. And then I guess what happened from there? Did you kind of start honing in on a certain type of cuisine, or kind of, I'm trying to piece together, I guess, what led you from then to now of, you know, opening your own spot and really focusing on the, you know, Eastern European side of your heritage? I guess what was kind of the in between there?
Yeah. So I always knew that I'd probably wind up in New York. Just I have family here, and this was, I mean, I still believe, and I know this is controversial, that New York is the food capital of the country.
I mean, I agree.
Yeah. I mean, there are naysayers. But I knew that I just wanted to work in kitchens, throughout New York. And, so that's what I did. And I didn't really, start focusing on a cuisine or narrowing down my options until I worked for a chef that pretty much point blank just told me that I should do that. And I was like, oh yeah, that's probably a good idea. And I was in the Strand bookstore. For those who don't know, the Strand bookstore is right below Union Square. It's a large old bookstore. And I found a copy of George Lang's Cuisine of Hungary. And George Lang was a restaurateur, a Hungarian restaurateur who was pretty big in like the 80s and the 90s. And he had a restaurant on the Upper West Side. And he wrote this very lengthy book that was very niche and very specific and all about Hungarian food history. And it shocked me because I had never really thought about it. I mean, you know, growing up, my grandmother did and didn't talk about her culture. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really know it was something that was maybe out in the world. So Long story short, I got the book and read the whole thing and was like, I think there's something here. There's some substance. You know, Eastern European food can be regarded as very heavy and meat focused,
right.
Fried foods, which it is. But there is this whole other side to it, especially now with the younger generation where it's becoming more vegetable and fruit forward and lots more going on in the fermentation and pickle department. And I just, I saw an opportunity to incorporate that into, you know, the chef that I was becoming. So
cool. That's
how that happened.
Really cool. Yeah. I mean, I was looking at the menu for your restaurant. It is quite different than what I would have, I guess, imagined if you just hear, you know, Hungarian restaurant. It's more, I guess, robust than that. And so is that kind of a goal of yours to share with the world that, you know, this Eastern European cuisine style is not as, I guess, like, as you describe it, heavy as people may think? Or what is kind of your goal with this?
Yeah, it's... So I've struggled with this for now, like a good portion of my career. In that, you know, I've never claimed to be fully the food that I cook. I've never claimed to be, you know, 100% authentic. It's not traditionally Hungarian. You're not going to come and find all these like veal and deer and ox and all these heavy stews, and you're not going to find that because food is such a personal thing. It's such a personal experience. And I think chefs, especially now, this generation of chefs are not defined by one thing. Mm-hmm. So when somebody is like, oh, you're the Hungarian chef, I'm like, no, I'm not necessarily the Hungarian chef. I'm this Hungarian, Eastern European, Jewish. There's all these kind of like facets to me and to my story. So when somebody, sorry.
No, you're fine.
Knock my headphones off because I'm really passionate.
Oh, you're like talking with your hands and knocking.
Yeah, I am. I think that there's so many different aspects to my story. So when somebody looks at the menu, which like on our daytime menu, we have a tuna melt, and I grew up eating tuna melts at a diner, or a Jewish deli. And somebody will come up to me and be like, tuna melts aren't Hungarian. And I was like, yeah, they're not. that's okay. but it's a damn good tuna melt. And like, you know, there's at night, our menu gets a little bit more wine bar, chic grandma candles, all lit.
Love that.
So, and for dinner, you know, there's also drawing from different ingredients, from Eastern European, Eastern European flavors. So caraway and dill and beet, right? Like those are to me very obvious staples in the ingredient realm. I play with those in different ways, and they may end up on a dish that isn't necessarily, you know, traditional or, you know, Eastern European, but I'm just stretching those flavors that are the core and the inspiration, and then just working with them in ways that I want to. So, I don't know, at least to me, that's what I'm doing.
Very, very cool. And I mean, the menu, I have it up now, is very, very interesting. And it seems like you've kind of explained in a great way how you are kind of trying to be this kaleidoscope of things. You're not just one color. You have a lot of different influences and inspirations. And I think that's what, you know, a lot of times, yeah, an authentic X restaurant is great, but so are these, you know, kind of different fusion creative style restaurants. I mean, it all sounds delicious to me. So I'm like, it tastes good. I don't care what country it's from.
Right.
There are
people who do care. Yeah. There are people. And I mean, when we first opened our doors, I don't know if he'll listen to this, but there was a food writer that did come to the front door with his wife and his baby. And he said to me, your palacinta, which is, I like, they're Hungarian crepes, uh-huh. and my grandmother made them for breakfast and for dessert. And he said, well, your palacinta is not authentic. And I'm very disappointed. What? And I was just like, you know, months, if not, you know, a year and a half of like working towards opening this restaurant. And I was tired of working like 24 hours around the clock. And I just was like, great, thank you, goodbye. And then, like, I just can't, like, you know, and it just, but there are people out there who really do care about the authenticity and the, which does matter in certain aspects. And I think that's like a rabbit hole we won't go down, but you know, it's okay to not be, to not play by the rules, in this scenario. So, you know, the fact that I, and he was talking about something like, you know, that I added pear to a crepe, and which is not traditional. It's just like, so I've dealt with a lot of that, oh, wow. Which is like a lot of like silly kind of comments like that. So,
interesting. Okay. Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, yeah. You did mention that it's a bit of a rabbit hole, and like, I totally, sure. You know, it's the same thing. I mean, like, I don't own a restaurant. I didn't go to culinary school. That's not my path, but I do work in the culinary world as well. And as a, you know, food content creator working for a food media company and, you know, posting my own content, that happens a lot on the internet as well. Like, say if I make a, I don't know, something from Mexican cuisine and it's not exactly right. as someone's grandmother made it. It's like there's so many different ways and techniques that even within the same culture, if you're doing it authentically, so-and-so, like there's different regions of that country that do it differently. There's different families that do it differently. You know, my mom's not even Italian, but she doesn't add breadcrumbs to her meatballs because that's just not how she likes them. You know, it's like there's so many different things and different twists yeah. that you can put on every single dish infinitely to what you like. And I, you know, it's kind of interesting to hear you talk about dealing with that as a restaurateur, because that's, you know, something that we deal a lot with in, you know, online content as well. So it seems like it's there's no end ever no. to like the level of scrutiny that comes with like making food of a certain, you know, cuisine or culture. It's like wherever you're doing it, whoever you're doing it for, someone's going to have something to say. And that's just our cross to that's bear, I guess. Is. Yeah, that's just what yeah. it is. So, oh, well, what can we do? All right, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors.
This episode is brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believe comfort food can be just that. Know where your food comes from. To learn more, visit rt11.com.
So now that you have the restaurant, I guess, when did you open it?
So we opened on November 8th of last mm-hmm. year, 2021. So we're coming up on our 1 year in just a few short weeks. So very exciting. And we're planning on having a big party that'll be open to the public. So I'm looking forward to that. Well,
congratulations. That's so exciting.
Thank you. Yeah, it has been a whirlwind. Yes. I mean, certainly nobody said that opening up a restaurant is easy. Uh-huh. and this business in general is not easy. So, but if anything, I think I feel like I have grown as a first-time restaurateur, and I've learned so much, and I, you know, every day is just something completely new and different. But I'm also incredibly fortunate to have a great staff and an amazing sous chef, an amazing partner that's helped us through really everything. Yeah. So I'm very lucky.
And so what was it like? I mean, I I lived in New York for many years. I just haven't for the last year or so. I'm back in Florida. I'm in Fort Lauderdale right now as we speak. killing, I was in between leases and kind of came home to be with my family for a bit for the holidays last year. And since rents got so bad in New York, I'm like, oh, let's hold on a little bit and see what we want to do. Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, New York is, you know, in my heart, my home. And it was very, very interesting to see, you know, late 2020 and into 2021, how many new restaurants were popping up. Obviously, we all mourned and, you know, grieved over the restaurants that closed during the pandemic, but it was almost like this new this phoenix out of the ashes or whatever of restaurants just popping up. And it seems like it's been kind of a restaurant renaissance, not to be all cliche about it, in New York. So what was that kind of like for you of being kind of part of that and opening at that time that where things were so dicey, I guess?
Yeah. Well, when I first started funding the restaurant, we funded the restaurant, the seed money, we did through Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So, and at the time I was actually in LA, my boyfriend, and also my business partner, Michael, still has a job in LA, though he is now bi-coastal. But we were living out there and we were planning to come back to New York for the restaurant. But I was talking to a lot of friends and colleagues and everyone just kept saying that there will be a big boom of restaurants. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, they were right. And I wanted to very much so ride that wave, because I felt like going into this kind of new vision of the food world, which it felt like, and I still think it feels like that. You know, I really wanted to be a part of that. So, even though it was during a global pandemic, it just in my gut felt like the right time. And I mean, sure, there were a lot of people that, you know, told me that was absolutely crazy and nuts, which it is. And, but yeah, I mean, as we opened up, I mean, we technically are still in the pandemic. Right. I don't know at what point we are in, but so I don't know how to like timeline this. But we opened up in a time that felt like there was this lull. So we still were, you know, everyone was wearing masks and we were doing checking vaccination cards, but I think we, you know, I mean, just fortunately, for us, it just had kind of timed out where like there wasn't this mass hysteria, mm-hmm. like in the opening, but yeah, we did go through another rise, you know, I'm just saying compared to like what restaurants that, you know, were here in New York, went through at the beginning was, you know, just seems a million times worse than I could have ever imagined.
Like the outdoor dining and having to, the way that they had to all just completely evolve into like, okay, now we're building like snow globes outside so that people can eat outside during the winter. Like, yeah, that was insane. So it seems like you missed most of that.
Yeah. And, you know, we went through, you know, we did go through a spike and we did have, you know, unfortunately we did have COVID cases and did have to shut down. But yeah, I mean, when folks ask me that, I just think about the chefs and the business owners that, went through it when it was so much more extreme. Yeah. And, you know, I didn't go through that myself on to that degree. So, we were a bit luckier. In that sense.
Yeah. So now that, you know, it's, you know, you've made it. It's been a year and, you know, I assume successful. So congratulations on all of that. How does it feel kind of looking back on the last year of just kind of like what you've accomplished, you know, what you've, you know, what reviews of the restaurant have been like, what does it kind of feel like to look back at this point?
It feels like in some ways it's been 10 years and other days it feels like it's been like a day or a week. It all has blurred together. But yeah, I'm just very excited for the future of Aggies. I think if anything, you know, this last year has just really proven that people really dig what we're doing and they get it, which is kind of surprising to me, which I know as someone who obviously opened up this restaurant and lives and breathes it, I should be like, yeah, well, that makes sense to me. But, you know, there are days like when, you know, we have tongue on the menu, like braised tongue, and we have deviled eggs and there's anchovies and things that like people, I think people mostly would turn their heads to, but we like sell out of it. And I, you know, am borscht, and we've had chilled borscht. We have hot borscht, and like, people are just really into this sort of food, and that has just made it all the more worth it, to go through everything that we did to get here. So, yeah, I'm very, very grateful.
Yeah. I'm looking at your menu. My dad is going to lose his mind. He's always been like, you know, wanting to eat the tongue sandwiches and the borscht. And we've all, you know, growing up, I'm one of three girls. So, you know, of course, just like three little girls growing up in South Florida, we would be like, ew, like, ew, what are you doing? Right. Like at the deli, you know, we're all eating just like eggs and turkey sandwiches, and he's getting the tongue sandwich and the borscht and all this, that, and the other. So yeah, he would lose his mind over this menu.
Oh, good.
I know. I'm dying to move back to New York. I'm just kind of waiting for the right, I guess, moment or...
Understood. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. It is crazy here. It is wildly expensive. Yes. Just to own a business, mm-hmm. but even just to, you know, live here, and, you know, we have a lot of staff that goes to school and are paying tuition. So it's a lot. It's very expensive.
Yeah. You know, luckily I have a great relationship with my family. So living at home with them for the time being is fun. It's not like we're like killing each other, but I'm like, as chic as it is that I'm 29 and living with my parents, should probably like figure that out at some point.
No, there's no, I mean, like the New York Times, I think I read an article about it that a lot of the younger generation is kind of like living at home now in order to like, I mean, think about it, so many people paying off debt and whatever. So it's, you know, it's okay.
I'll be back eventually. I literally was just in town. Like I just got back 2 days ago. I was there for 2 weeks. I go a lot because a lot of my friends are still there. And I'm like, I need to hang out with people my own age for a little bit and socialize a bit and eat. I mean, you know, the food scene down here does not even like hold a candle to what it is in New York. No offense to South Florida, but it's just, as you and I agreed on first thing, you know, that's the best food scene in the country, in our opinion. It so sure yeah, is. I definitely miss mm-hmm. it all the time. So what are you kind of hopeful for looking forward? Do you want, like, what are your big, lofty, ambitious goals, to have multiple restaurants or just to kind of ride this one through? Or what are you kind of hopeful for?
I just want to afford to be able to turn on our lights in the morning. No, and things are – no, and, like, that's always my response to that question, which is, like, partly it's true. You know, we're still going through our first year and we're doing okay. And if anything, we're, you know, the reviews and everything have been just so amazing. But yeah, I mean, sometimes it's hard to see past tomorrow. But I know I'm seeing my boyfriend Michael's face being like, yeah, right. he doesn't love when I start coming up with new ideas, because he's like, we just have to get through this first. And I was like, no, I know. And yes, we do. But I am working on, I'm working on my cookbook, which will come out in 2024. So that's really like
exciting.
The other part of my life that really has just begun. So I'm excited to hop on that. And also, yeah, I mean, we've talked about like other iterations of Aggies or like smaller Aggies. But I would love to have another restaurant one day, potentially. I mean, if I could really dream, it would be like one in upstate New York. That's kind of all about like, you know, like hearth cooking, mm-hmm. but like Eastern European style, cool. like very fisherman. So that's kind of like that's a far off dream. Right now, I just need to worry about getting through tonight's service, turning the lights on and off, and writing this cookbook, which is
that's a beast in and of itself. So good luck.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm scared, but also thrilled to take the ride.
Yeah. So. No, I mean, it's a beast, but it'll be worth it in the end. I'm excited to see how that comes out. I'm sure that's going to be awesome. So yeah, you've got a lot of stuff in the works, and I totally get the sentiment whenever people ask me what I want in 5 years. I'm like, I don't even know what I want in 5 minutes. So yeah. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe that's like a millennial thing of us where we're like very present minded and just like one thing at a time. But I totally understand. You are preaching to the choir.
Yeah. Well, I need to, I think I do have to focus and be in the moment for sure. As a chef and you just like, your brain is always scattered. Yes. And you're always running across the room. And there's 10 different people talking to you at mm-hmm. once, but yeah, it's good to be able to focus on one thing at a time. That's a nice idea.
Yes. Well, is there anything else important about your culinary journey or story that I didn't ask you?
I don't think so. I think you covered everything.
All right,
so
all the high points.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks so much for kind of taking me through step by step. It was an interesting but exciting journey, it seems, to get to where you are now. And I'm just happy to hear that everything's going well, and you know, wish you luck on everything you've got cooking, literally and figuratively, and excited to see how it all goes.
Yeah, well, you'll have to let me know when you're in town and bring your dad along. I'll make sure I got a tongue sandwich.
Oh my God, he will literally lose his mind. I give him a hard time because even when I did live there, they didn't come visit me enough. They're like, why would we come to New York? Come visit us in Florida. The weather's nicer. I'm like, you guys have no idea what you're missing.
Yeah, no, it's hard to get Floridians out of that mindset. It's not worth it. It's a whole other podcast.
I know.
On South Florida, like shenanigans. Like, I mean, really.
Yeah, we could like team up for a podcast duo. Just like life growing up in South Florida in the 90s was like a whole vibe.
I mean, so many guests. I mean, it would be great. So.
Well, thank you so much for being here and sharing everything with me. It's been an absolute pleasure. I appreciate you.
Thank you so much, Alexa.
Thank you so much for listening. To learn more about the food and drink discovery platform that is the FeedFeed, head to thefeedfeed.com. If you have a food story to tell or want us to interview a blogger, cookbook author, chef, or restaurateur, we would love your suggestions. Just send us a DM on Instagram. See you next time. The FeedFeed podcast is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.